Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 87, Prayers of the Personified Vedas, text number 30. This verse, by the way, Prabhupada quotes it in Bhagavad Gita. It's quoted by Lord Chaitanya in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita in his teachings to Rupa Goswami. It's quoted in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. It's quoted in another book, I think it's called Renunciation Through Wisdom or something like that. And of course, it's quoted in the Krishna book, or translated in the Krishna book. So, it's quite a important verse, famous verse. It's only one of these prayers that I ever memorized many years ago. When I came across it in the Gita and the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I said, oh, this must be an important verse. So I'd basically forgotten it, so it's nice to be able to review it while preparing for this class. So the word meanings, aparimitaha, countless, dhruvaha, permanent, tanubritaha, the embodied living entities, yadi, if, sarvagataha, omnipresent, tarhi, then, na, not, shashyata, sovereignty, iti, such, niyamaha, rule, dhruva, O unchanging one, na, not, itarata, otherwise, ajani, was generated, cha, and, yat mayam, from whose substance, tut, from that, avimucha, not separating itself, niyantre, regulator, bhavet, must be, samam, equally present, anujanantam, of those who supposedly know, yat, which, amatam, misunderstood, mata, of what is known, dushtataya, because of the imperfection. When I was looking at this verse, I was noticing there's a lot of A's. Sometimes a particular syllable or sound is repeated in these. Of course, this is poetry, so it's part of the alankar or ornamentation. So I did a count. There are 45 syllables with A in this verse. And out of those, only 8 are long. I always think about pronunciation, how it might be good if we worked on our pronunciation a little. So I think so many devotees, their pronunciation would be helped. They've learned one thing, the difference between a long A and a short A. That makes so much difference. So when I chant this, I'm going to accent a little more, the long A's here, so you get the idea. One thing is, the long A's, there are other long syllables too. For example, consonant conjuncts, when you have two letters together like ST or something like that. Those are also long, but that's a little more subtle, maybe trying to find those. But the A's, at least, it helps you get the meter of the verse when you find where the long A's are. And sometimes there's a whole string of short syllables, and we, maybe because of our English, you know, American brains or whatever, we want to add long syllables in there. We don't like da 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 da. Sometimes there's a string of those short syllables. So in this verse, it's like that. So I'm going to make an effort to, you'll see where the long syllables, the long A's are. Aparimita dhruvas tanubrito yadi sarva gatas. Tari na shashyate iti niyamo dhruva netarata. Tari na shashyate iti Ajanichayan mayam taravimuchaniyan tribhave. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya. Aparimita druvas tanubrito yadi sarvagatas. Tarina shashyateti niyamo dhruvanetaratha. Ajanichayan mayam taravimuchaniyan tribhave. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya. Aparimita druvas tanubrito yadi sarvagatas. Tarina shashyate tiniyamo dhruvane taratha. Ajanichayan mayam taravimuchaniyan tribhavet. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya. Aparimita druvas tanubrito yadi sarvagatas. Tarina shashyate tiniyamo dhruvane taratha. Ajanichayan mayam taravimuchaniyan tribhave. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya. Tarina shashyate tiniyamo dhruvane taratha. Ajanichayan mayam taravimuchaniyan tribhave. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya.
Ladies.
Aparimita druvas tanubrito yadi sarvagatas. Samam anujanantam yadamatam matadushtataya. Translation. Listen carefully. I know myself, sometimes we read these, and when we get to the end, I say, what? What was that exactly? If the countless living entities were all pervading and possessed forms that never changed, you could not possibly be their absolute ruler, O immutable one. But since they are your localized expansions and their forms are subject to change, you do control them. Indeed, that which supplies the ingredients for the generation of something is necessarily its controller, because a product never exists apart from its ingredient cause. It is simply illusion for someone to think that he knows the Supreme Lord, who is equally present in each of his expansions, since whatever knowledge one gains by material means must be imperfect. Purport by disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Now today I'm going to, usually I read through the purport all the way and then go back and pick things out, but this purport I want to kind of explain things as I go along. One thing I wanted to mention just as a side note here, few days ago when Akuti Mataji was giving class, she, and at the end of the purport, now we're seeing in this section that Sridhar Swami, not only does he write a commentary, but he writes a verse for every verse. So that's why we're getting a verse by Sridhar Swami at the end of each one of these verses. So in verse 27, the last line is, Haring vina naiva mritim taranti. Now those of you who read Prabhupada's books regularly may recognize this. Prabhupada quotes it all the time. And he usually just says, it is said. Or it is said in the Vedic literature, something like that. Haring vina naiva mritim taranti. Which means, without Lord Hari, they will never cross beyond death. So as Prabhupada would translate it often, only Lord Hari can deliver the living entities. Lord Shiva cannot, none of the demigods can, only Lord Hari. So for many years, I didn't know where this came from. Prabhupada just says, it is said. And then I heard, I think it was from Gopi Pranadana Prabhu, that he said it was from a commentary of Sridhar Swami. And then I still didn't know exactly where it was. So now I finally know this is where it's from, exactly this line that Prabhupada liked to quote. Now it's interesting because for Prabhupada it carries the same weight as the Vedas, because other times Prabhupada, there are certain, still if you look in the shloka book, sometimes you'll see source unknown, especially sometimes if Prabhupada quotes some short line. So this is one of those short lines, at least the source was unknown for me. But for Prabhupada it carries as much weight as the Vedic literature or Vedic Shruti, at least it seems that way, because he uses it to resolve certain questions. So this is like a Vedic injunction. I was always thinking of it that way. Oh, this must be a line from the Vedas. And then when I discovered, oh, it's by Sridhar Swami, it's not actually from the Vedas. I thought that was interesting. But for Prabhupada, it doesn't matter. If Sridhar Swami says it's as good as coming from the Vedas. So this is, and you'll see this if you read Prabhupada's books, you'll come across this line again. Only Lord Hari can deliver us from birth and death. So now, diving into the purport. Because the conditioned soul cannot directly understand the Supreme, the Vedas commonly refer to that Supreme in such impersonal terms as Brahman and Om Tat Sat. Now it seems like the purport here is beginning by dealing with the end of the verse, where it says it's illusion for someone to think that he knows the Supreme Lord, since whatever knowledge one gains by material means must be imperfect. Actually, one thing about this, the Sanskrit here, now this is common, of course, we have to remember that this is poetry. So in poetry, a lot of things are suggested. In fact, this is the heart of poetry, really. Good poetry is, you kind of suggest things, and the reader's mind fills in the blanks. So there's a lot of, you might say, reading between the lines here. Sometimes there's just a few words, but in the translation, you have two long sentences because it's kind of implied. The rest of the meaning is implied by those few words. It's almost like sutras. In some ways, poetry is in some ways like a sutra automatically, just because the form is condensed. It's not an elaborate use of words. So here, there are just a few words at the end of the purport. Anujanantam are those who supposedly know yet which amatam misunderstood mata of what is known dushtataya because of imperfection. I often do this. I look at the word for word, and then I go to the translation. I say, how did it get from here to there? Now, Prabhupada, of course, he puts a lot of purports in his translations. But one thing about Gopi Puranadana Prabhu and Ridhanana Maharaj, they're very strict about doing things very literally. Sometimes they call Prabhupada, because Prabhupada's classic translations of some of the verses. But generally speaking, they try to be very strictly literal in their translations and not add things. So to give the meaning very directly what's been given by the words. So even then, it takes a lot of sentences just to describe what's in the verse, the Sanskrit. So beginning again, because the conditioned soul cannot directly understand the Supreme, the Vedas commonly refer to that Supreme Truth in such impersonal terms as Brahman and Om Tat Sat. If an ordinary scholar presumes to know the confidential meaning of these symbolic references, he should be rejected as an impostor. In the words of Sri Kena Upanishad 2.1, Yadi manyase suvedeti dabram evapi nunam tvam veta brahmano rupam yadasya tvam yadasya deveshu. Another point I want to make about Sanskrit is that it's 100% phonetic. Probably would point this out. In English you have B-U-T but, P-U-T put. It's spelled the same, but in one word it's pronounced and another it's pronounced u. But in Sanskrit it's not like that. If it's a short A, it's a short A. So similarly, the sound, the letter E is pronounced A. It's not pronounced E. It's pronounced E. So it's Avapi, not Evapi. Or it's not Veda, it's Veda. So the translation of this verse from the Kena Upanishad. If you think you know Brahman well, then your knowledge is very meager. If you think you can identify Brahmans from among the other demigods, Brahmans. Oh, I'm sorry. This is why we need proofreaders, because editors sometimes make mistakes. If you think you can identify Brahman's form from among the demigods, indeed you know but little. And again, this is also from the Kena Upanishad, two verses later. Yasya matam tasya matam matam yasya navedasaha avigyatam vijanantam vigyatam avijanatam. Whoever denies having an opinion about the Supreme Truth is correct in his opinion, whereas one who has his own opinion about the Supreme does not know him. He is unknown to those who claim to know him and can only be known by those who do not claim to know him. I thought this was interesting because it says, if you say you have no opinion, that's the right opinion. But if you have no opinion, it's going to be the right opinion. Anyway, that's the way it's written. That's the idea. A little humor, I guess, in the Upanishad. So it's right to say, I don't know. Like Lord Brahma, he says, Jananta eva janantu kim bahukya name prabho. What is it? Manuso vapuso vacho vaibhavam tava gocharam. In Lord Brahma's prayers in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto. He says, there are those who say, I know Krishna. He said, let them speak like that. As far as I'm concerned, he's completely beyond my body, mind, and words. So that's Lord Brahma's attitude. I don't know anything about Krishna. So continuing, Acharya Sridhar Swami gives the following explanation of this verse. Now, I struggled with this pronoun, this. I don't want to edit the editors here, but I didn't know if it was the Kena Upanishad verse or the verse that were this Bhagavatam verse. In fact, I had to look up in the commentary of Sridhar Swami, which I happen to have for the 10th canto. And it seems to be that this here means the Paramita Duras, the Bhagavatam verse, and not the Kena Upanishad verse. Although it seems like it could apply to the Kena Upanishad verse as well. Acharya Sridhar Swami gives the following explanation of this verse. Many philosophers have studied the mysteries of life from various perspectives and have formed widely differing theories. The Advaitavadis, for example, propose that there is only one living being and one power of illusion, avidya, that covers him, producing the appearance of plurality. So I'll pause here after this sentence. When I first read the verse, it says, in translation, if the countless living entities were all pervading, so my first question was, does that mean all of them together? If the countless living entities all together are all pervading? Or each one of them is all pervading? So as we go on here, I think we'll see that it's referring to the idea that, well, actually, we'll read more, that there's only one jiva that's all-pervading. Or if each one of them also, it could be either way, if each jiva is all-pervading, you could not possibly be their absolute ruler, is what it says here. So this is the first, but this is a, now we understand here, these are, they're speculating, and maybe they read the Vedas too, and they get certain shlokas, and they're trying to understand them. So they make this proposition. Could it be, or they're actually proposing, that the, or the question is being raised here, what if they're all pervading? Now, one thing that's interesting is, the Sanskrit for this is sarvagata. So, sarvagata, translated here, is omnipresent, but, so it means, you can say it means all pervasive. Now, this word is used in Bhagavad Gita, Nitya Sarvagata Stanur, for the jiva. And here it says, if they were Sarvagata, they couldn't be covered. So here we can see there are two meanings. Sarvagata can also mean present everywhere, omnipresent, present everywhere. So the jiva can be present everywhere if there are unlimited jivas. Therefore, they fill all the space, they fill everything. Or the jiva could be, the other idea that's presented here is that the jiva is by its own nature all-pervasive, just like God is. So naturally, you read this, you scratch your head, you say, well, how can the jiva be all-pervasive? That means the jiva would be God. So these are the kinds of things that these philosophers wrestle with, these different ideas. So, let's see, where am I? Okay, so there, the Advaitavadis propose that there's only one jiva, and there's one avidya that covers that one jiva. But this hypothesis leads to the absurd conclusion that when any one living being becomes liberated, everyone obtains liberation. So when I read that sentence, you just say, yeah. Or do you think, what? Why? That's what I do. I say, why does it suggest that? So let's look at this again. The idea is that, so what is the hypothesis? That there's one jiva, and there's one avidya. So the idea is that means that we are also that one jiva. We are also Brahman. We are God. So if one, you know, the idea that there are individuals like us, that we are individual persons, I always think of Descartes as, I think, therefore I am. So his, what he thought was an undeniable conclusion was that I exist as a individual living entity. But according to the Mayavadis, that's not true, actually. That's illusion, to think that you, Descartes, exist separately from somebody else. The idea, their idea is that, no, there's only one. And the idea that you think that I am this individual living entity and I'm not you, that's an illusion. Because I am you, and you are he, and we are, what is that, whatever that song is about the Beatles. We're all together. We're all one. So if one of us becomes enlightened, free of avidya, then that one is all. There's no difference between the all and the one. So if one is liberated, that means everybody has to be liberated, because there is no really everybody. There's only one. So that's the idea that's being possessed here. So we say that's an absurd conclusion, because even the Mayavadis, who are trying to understand these things, they're trying to get liberation, And they think, for example, that my guru is a Mukta Purusha. My guru is liberated. I'm not liberated, but he is. You say, no, if it's all one, if he's liberated, you are too. So that's the idea here. I don't know if I made it more complicated or... So we'll press on here. There's more of these absurd conclusions coming up. If, on the other hand, there are many avidyas, so the last proposition was that there's only one avidya, one all-pervasive ignorance, big cloud, you might say, covering everything. If, on the other hand, there are many avidyas, just a bunch of clouds here and there, to cover the one living being, now we're still with the one living being, each avidya will cover only some part of him. And we would have to talk about his becoming partly liberated at a particular time while his other parts remain in bondage. This is obviously absurd. For one thing, he has no parts. This is an axiom of Brahman. He has no parts. Ekam Brahma Dvitiya Nasti. He is one. Ekam. Thus, the plurality of living beings is an unavoidable conclusion. Okay. So I don't know if I want to go rehash why this is an unavoidable conclusion, but it rules out two other possibilities, which are really the only other two possibilities that were just discussed. Furthermore, we're not done yet, there are other theoreticians, namely the proponents of Nyaya and Vaisheshika. Now here we can look at the Sanskrit here. Vaisheshika. Vaisheshika. Ka. There's no she in this word. There's no long I. Vaisheshika. Actually, this word Vaisheshika, it comes from the word Vishesha. Vishesha. Just like Nirvishesha. Vishesha means distinction or uniqueness. Just like Krishna is described as Vishesha Shobham. He has unique loveliness. His loveliness is different from our loveliness, his beauty. So Vishesha means that there are certain entities that are absolutely real, you can say. They have a distinction. In Vaisheshika and Nyaya philosophies, these are enumerated. I think there's nine. I think Nyaya has nine and Vaisheshika has five or something. I forget what they are. Earth, water, fire are included in there, but then they have some other things. So these two philosophies, by the way, are the six philosophies of India, traditional Indian philosophies. These two are related, Nyaya Vaisheshika. Sometimes they're even hyphenated, Nyaya Vaisheshika philosophy. And Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa, these two philosophies go together. Uttara Mimamsa is Vedanta, Vyasadeva. And then the other two, whatever they are, I won't get into it right now. They're also related. So there's like three pairs of that kind of go to. Oh, Sankhya and Yoga. Because yoga is based on the philosophy of Sankhya. It's philosophical. The philosophical foundation of yoga is Sankhya philosophy. So they go together too. So in any case, let's go back here. Furthermore, there are other theoreticians, namely the proponents of Nyaya and Vaisheshika, who claim that the jiva soul is infinite in size. If souls were infinitesimal, now think about what's being said here, if souls were infinitesimal, these scholars argue... Now, actually, I want to jump. I hope I'm not jumping around too much. But this is, at the end here, it says, at least according to the axioms of Nyaya Vaisheshika metaphysics. So what is an axiom? An axiom is something that is taken to be indubitable. You can't doubt it. It's absolutely true. It's obviously true. It's taken as a fundamental principle, and then from there you can do other things. There are axioms in philosophy, there are axioms in mathematics, there are certain axioms in different fields of knowledge. For example, you could say A is equal to A. So can you prove that? Well, no, but obviously it's true, right? That's an axiom. So we'll work from there. If A is equal to A, then A is equal to B, and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. So anyway, you begin with axioms, fundamental principles. So according to the Nyaya Vaisheshika metaphysics, if souls were infinitesimal, this to them is axiomatic, if they were infinitesimal, these scholars argue, they would not pervade their own bodies. So think of this idea. That's what they say is axiomatic. If the soul is infinitesimal, it wouldn't be able to pervade the body. So we would probably argue, even in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says the soul's in one place, but it pervades the body. Just like the sun pervades the body. Although I've seen other translations by acharyas that they take that verse to be the super soul and not the soul. But in any case, so this word infinitesimal, by the way, for many years I've always wondered about this 1/10,000th the tip of a hair, because how can you measure something? Even if it's that small, if it's spirit, how can you measure it in three dimensions? If you take a hair and spit it, 100 times, and you split that part 100 times, still you have something that you can measure with a very small caliper. Somehow you can measure it in three dimensions, but it's spirit. So I've always felt that, well, this is metaphorical. And when I heard Gopi Pranidhan Prabhu say that, I cheered. I said, yay! Because I thought that way, but I never heard anyone verify it. But then this word infinitesimal, and I thought, Prabhupada also uses this word. Of course, he would say infinite simal, but infinitesimal. Infinitesimal means infinitesimally small. And they, I know in mathematics, they say approaching zero. It's as close to being nothing in size as you can get. So infinitesimal, or you could write mathematically, 1/infinity. So if that's the size of the jiva, then it's really small. So these Vaisheshika Nyaya philosophers, they say, if that's the size of the soul in the body, then how can it pervade the whole body? So they say that's axiomatic. That's just logical. So then they say, whereas if they, the jivas, were of medium size, say the solid size of your heart or something, or somewhere between infinite and infinitesimal, they would be divisible into parts and thus could not be eternal. So this idea that the medium, it means if it's not, so infinitesimal means you can't divide it any further than that, because it's as small as you can get. So they're saying if it's not infinitesimal but somehow larger, maybe 1/10,000th the tip of a hair, you could still divide it smaller. So then they say then it's not eternal, because eternal means it's always what it is. So if you divide it in half, then it's not what it was anymore. It's two different things. Then again, at least according to the axioms of Nyaya Vaisheshika metaphysics. But if the numerous, so this is, I think, the counter-argument coming here. But if the numerous eternal jivas are each infinitely large, that's what we're saying, or the Vaishnavas are saying, because that's what the Nyaya Vaisheshika is. They're saying it can't be medium. The jiva can't be medium. The jiva can't be infinitesimal. Can't be infinitesimal. Therefore, the jiva must be infinite. So the Vaishnavas say, but if the numerous eternal jiva souls are each infinitely large, how could they be covered by any power of bondage, whether belonging to avidya or to the Supreme Lord himself? According to this theory, there can be no illusion for the soul, no limitations from which to be liberated. So Prabhupada would state this simply, for God, how are we covered by illusion? It doesn't make any sense. The infinite souls must eternally remain as they are without change. This would mean that the souls would all be equal to God, since he would have no scope for controlling these all-pervading, unchanging rivals. So this is really the essential point of this verse. If the living entities were all pervasive, how could they be under control? Now it also says, there are two characteristics. If they were all pervasive, and if they didn't change. So this puzzled me a little. I thought, well, what does not changing have to do with it? That because they change, that means they're being controlled. Now, actually, one of the translations, I can't read all these translations, but I have them here. But in one of these translations that Prabhupada gives, he basically elaborates on that. And he says, changing means that the jivas, tanumritam means holding a body, supporting the body. So one of the characteristics of the jiva is that he reincarnates. So there's some law governing that reincarnation. So who's enforcing that law? Someone above the jiva. So that's why this is significant, that they do change. And that implies that there's a controller above them. So I'm going to, because it's late and I have more things to say, but I'll just read through the end of this. The Vedic Shruti mantras which affirm unequivocally, yes, the mastery of the Lord over the individual souls cannot be validly contradicted. Now I wasn't going to talk more, but this is important. Everything these philosophers, some of them not so much, but generally speaking, at least of course Vyasadeva, what the Upanishads say, that's the final word. You don't argue with it. You try to figure it out, but you don't argue with it. So this is, you can't contradict them. So the Mayavadis, they do that because they accept all the mantras that have to do with oneness, and there are enough of them, but there are so many mantras that have to do with duality also. For example, there are so many mantras that glorify the Supreme Lord and mention His qualities. And we have to look and say, well, I don't have those qualities, so I must be different from that all-pervasive Supreme Personality of Godhead. I'm not all beautiful, I'm not all perfect and all powerful and so on. So you can't contradict, so I have to somehow figure out how these two can go together. A true philosopher must accept the statements of Shruti as reliable authority on all matters they touch. Certainly in numerous places the Vedic literatures contrast the Supreme Lord's perpetual unchanging oneness with the ever-changing embodiments of living beings caught up in the cycle of birth and death. So that's that same point. So Srila Sridhar Swami prays, Anta yata yanta sarva lokasya gita shrutya yuktya chaivam eva vaseyah ya sarvanya sarva shakti nrisingha shrimantam tam cheta sabaiva lambe. In my heart I take shelter of Him who is glorified as the inner controller of all the worlds, and whom the Vedas ascertain in truth through logical reasoning. He is Nrsimha, the omniscient and omnipotent Lord of the Goddess of Fortune. Now you may have picked up in these shlokas of Sridhar Swami, he's always praying to Lord Nrsimhadev. So Nrsimhadev is his Ishta Devata, his worshipable deity. So his name often comes up. Now one thing again to get the pronunciation. The word is not Nrsimha. It's Nr. Now in English we have a lot of words that begin with TR, DR, BR, but we don't have NR. But in Sanskrit you have NR. So it's Nr. It's not Na. Nr. And the second part is not Shrim. There's no R after the S. It's Nrsimha. And the dot over the M means it's not exactly an M. You don't bring your lips together. It's more like a M sound. Nrsimha. So, all glories to Sridhar Swami. Let me just read through the translation. If the countless living entities were all-pervading and possessed forms that never change, you could not possibly be their absolute ruler, O immutable one. But since they are your localized expansions and their forms are subject to change, you do control them. Indeed, that which supplies the ingredients for the generation of something is necessarily its controller, because a product never exists apart from its ingredient cause. I have questions about that sentence, but it is simply illusion for someone to think that he knows the Supreme Lord, who is equally present in each of his expansions, since whatever knowledge one gains by material means must be imperfect. So, I usually like to end at this time, but any discussion on this? Maharaj?
Just a brief question and a brief comment. But the question is, well, I'll start with the comment.
Yeah, because I'll forget if you do it in that way.
this idea that something is ultimately that which caused it. There are specific verses in the 11th canto that make that point, that support that in one sense we're all Krishna. In one sense, Krishna is everything. including mm-hmm. us and everything else, even material or spiritual.
Yeah.
The question is that if the living entity were unchanging, well, the living entity as not living entity in terms of the conditioned soul, but living entity in its as a soul, in intrinsic identity, is actually unchanging.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the spiritual world, there's still very loving, or depends on Vaikuntha or Loka Vrindavan, but there is the sovereignty. They are still controlled, you know, aside from Mother Yasoda, who scares Krishna with a stick, but they are controlled, even though they're unchanging. So that's the question. Why is it contradictory that if they're not changeable, then they can't be controlled? They are controlled even in their intrinsic nature and spiritual world.
Yeah, in Bhagavad Gita also there's the characteristic of being achala, immovable, which is always like, what does it mean? You can't move the soul? It seems like a soul moves around here and there. Bodies are moving, the soul's in it. So achala there, it's the same idea. It's not changing from his constitutional position. So the only thing I can say in reply to that is in the verse, the jivas are referred to as tanubhuta, as I said, tanubhuta, embodied jivas. So the embodied jivas are changing, and so they have to change their bodies. Even though the jiva, what is that, asango hyayam purusha, in one sense we never mix with this world, but because of our identification with these bodies, I think you can say it, as we can say about many things, and sometimes we say, in a sense, just like you're saying, in a sense, everything is Krishna, in one sense, because it's all his energy, it's not different from him. So in a sense, the jiva, because the jiva is tanubhuta, the jiva is changing, because he's identifying this body, and he's forced to change those bodies. In that sense, he's changing. Even just like you could say, I'm changing because I'm changing cars. I get out of one car and I get into another car. So there's been some change in my position. Whereas Krishna, he doesn't change. His form never changes. His form is eternal. Well, even though they appear sometimes temporary, his forms are all eternal. Whereas we take on temporary forms that change. So in a sense, we change along with them. We go from one situation to another, where Krishna absolutely never changes. So there seems to be there's that fine difference between the two.
We could also suggest that there's a different type of control also, which is implied.
Mm-hmm.
In the material context, it's you can almost say mechanistic, or according to the laws of nature, they're changing, including karma, whereas spiritual control is different. It's an exchange of love and different type of control. Okay.
There's an interesting, in one of Prabhupada's translations to this verse, he says, if the living entities accept their position, I'm not seeing it here, but basically he says, they can be happy being the controllers of so many things. He says. So he makes the point basically that we're controllers, we're tiny controllers, and we should be satisfied just with what we can control and not want to become God to control everything. Jamashtami Prabhu?
You were commenting on how Vidyananda Maharaj and Gopikrandam Prabhu translated literally. And there was one conversation that Prabhupada had with Sarva Bhavana, you know, about
Bhava Artha.
Why did Vidyananda Maharaj and Gopikrandam decide?
Well, I think they were taking one thing. Part of what they're doing, they want to satisfy scholars. So, in that sense, they wanted it to be academically acceptable. And also, they're taking the position of, you know, we're still sadhakas, and we're not in the realized position of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada Krishna is speaking through him. So, whatever his realizations, his transcendental ecstasies are coming out, but we can't imitate that, so let's just stick to the script here. I think is the safe way for us to go. We're just going to stick to the script, and this is literally what it says here in the verse. And we'll explain in the purport. And also, of course, what are the purports? They're basically just quoting the acharyas and all of their purports. So that was the position that they took in writing these commentaries.
Yeah, Prabhupada instructed Sarva Bhavana. That was the third way.
Oh, he told him that? I looked on the database for this word, bhava, artha, and bhava, artha. I couldn't find it anywhere.
In the newest version of the database, it's not there, but it was in the previous one, and I've deleted that.
Maybe I haven't looked
in
it.
I found it before, and I looked again, and I couldn't find it. So I think that's what happened. Most of Sarva Bhavana's works aren't in there. I don't know. Weird.
Prangavinda Prabhu?
In Calcutta, when Srila Prabhupada was giving class on Bhagavatam, he quoted this, Krishna pranaya vikriti ladini shakti asmat ekatmana bhuvi puradehe vedam gato tau chaitannayakam prakatam aduna tattayam chaitamaptam radha bhavodhuti shivulitam naomi krishna. Prabhupada says, so they were one, then they became two. So in your class you mentioned, when you have if you say something eternal, you cannot say it became. That word cannot be used in a sense. So after Prabhupada finished the class, Atma Singh, he asked that question. If you say absolute truth was one, then they became two, then now becoming again one. So are they eternal or how? Which come first, which come second? Instead of answering exactly like Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, Prabhupada says, Radharani came first.
Yeah.
Radharani came first. So then the Sadhadana Maharaj, at that time he was sannyasi, later on to Prabhupada. How to understand this? He says, Radharani is Swarup Shakti manifest, all the four. They are all eternal. But if you think which one came first, to your eye is the one thing. But eternally they exist. Even though it says that, ekatmana bhuvi, they were one before, now they are two, then again becoming one. So how the eternity is maintained.
All right, we'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.